This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. Sometimes important advances in science happen by accident, or even develop out of mistakes. Perhaps most famous is Louis Pasteur's discovery of antibiotics, which some say came about after he sneezed on his experiments with bacteria. Or there's the more recent story of a researcher who left an experiment on his lab bench over a long weekend and came back to find a material scientists had been trying for decades to make. Today's story is in the same vein. My guest is Dr. Patricia Hunt. She's a Meyer Distinguished Professor at Washington State University, but in 1998, Scientific American gave her a different title, the Accidental Toxicologist. And she's here with me today to tell that story. Patricia Hunt, welcome to Living Lab.
Thanks, Heather.
Now, let's actually go back and start with the research that you were initially interested in, which comes down to this kind of interesting phenomenon that human beings are not as good as other animals at producing normal babies, and our ability to do so declines dramatically with age. So what was the question there that you were trying to answer?
Yeah, I think we need to clarify that it's probably half of human beings, the female half. And it's really interesting because we don't do a very good job of making eggs compared to other species. And this has been the focus of my research for my entire career. What I want to know before I hang my lab coat up is why, as women age, are we at an increased risk of having a chromosomally abnormal baby like a Down syndrome baby?
So you say we're not very good at producing eggs, but it's not that we're not producing enough of them. It's that we're not good at producing normal eggs or
right,
quality eggs.
Right. The genetic quality of our eggs is compromised by others, by comparison with other species.
So when you started this research, what was known about this phenomenon?
Actually, a lot, because there were studies in the 1970s just trying to understand when pregnancies fail, when we have miscarriages, why do they fail? And what those studies found is they fail, half of them, because they're chromosomally abnormal and not compatible with survival. Everyone knows Down syndrome because those babies can survive, walk around as adults. But most chromosome abnormalities actually cause the death of the pregnancy. So there's quite a lot known about the frequency. We've been trying to get at the cause, and we've been trying to understand why the problem gets so much greater with age.
So why does it get greater with age?
Well, you know, that turns out to be not quite so simple. I think I thought for my entire career that we were questing after the magic bullet. You know, take this pill if you're over 35 and you'll have a, you know, normal, healthy baby. And it turns out it's a much more complicated problem than that. And everything we've learned in the last 10 or 15 years has suggested that there are a number of different factors that come into play, kind of a perfect storm, that creates an age problem that increases the likelihood that the egg that will be ovulated at near the end of the reproductive lifespan of the woman will be chromosomally abnormal.
And of course, we've exacerbated this problem socially just because so many women are having children later in life.
Yes, have we ever. It's been a really remarkable shift in a period of a couple of decades where we've actually changed the age at first birth, dramatically pushing it up. You know, sort of every few years, there's an increase. And that's not a really good recipe for us simply because age is such a major factor.
I mean, biologically, this has always been the case biologically, that as we would get older, that we would see more chromosomal abnormalities, but we wouldn't have had this problem as such, this issue of more and more abnormal pregnancies, if it weren't for this social change, right? That evolutionarily we've typically had our babies in our teens, in our 20s, and so this wasn't really an issue.
Right. We didn't live to these later ages to keep having babies. But yeah, it's absolutely true. It's also true, though, that there's really a high frequency, even at lower ages, compared to other species. It just gets much, much, much worse with age. So, you know, even young women can have Down syndrome babies.
Now,
and miscarriages.
Now, it's not just Down syndrome, and it's not necessarily just the chromosomal abnormalities. In recent decades, we've seen at least increased documentation, whether or not there's been an actual increase in the frequency of a variety of different reproductive problems. I mean, there's a whole suite of different things going on here.
Right, for both males and females.
So what are some of the other issues besides just the chromosomal abnormalities in eggs?
Well, one of the questions that's sort of been plaguing people in my field is males. are sperm counts dropping? Is the incidence of infertility increasing for both men and women? And these types of things have made people like me wonder whether they're not environmental exposures that are driving some of these effects.
Well, and so we'll get back to the environmental exposures. I mean, there's the decreasing sperm counts. We're also seeing an increase in premature births.
Right.
Increases in premature puberty in kids. And so all of those are coming together to make not only yourself, but a lot of people in the field wonder if there's something in our environment that's
driving these things.
Yeah. Right. All right. In case you're just joining us, I'm talking with Dr. Patricia Hunt. She's Meyer Distinguished Professor at Washington State University. And in 1998, Scientific American called her the accidental toxicologist. So, Patricia Hunt, what was the accident that happened? You were studying this phenomenon of decreased fertility, I guess, with age, but studying it in mice in your lab. And what happened that sidetracked you to start looking at environmental exposures?
What we were doing is we were looking at the effect on eggs. So eggs go through a complex growth process before they're ovulated. And in the human, it takes several months. So it's not just one cycle produces one egg. It actually takes several cycles to produce an egg. And we had this idea, it wasn't a new one, that what was going on with advancing age that caused more chromosomally abnormal eggs were slight fluctuations in the hormones that control our reproduction. And so we were bringing in mouse models where we thought we could alter the hormone environment that that egg was growing in to see if we could actually see this in mouse. Now, I have to add here that by comparison with the human, mouse has a really, really low incidence of abnormal eggs. So we were testing against a very low background, 1% to 2%, and bringing in some mutant mice to see if we could increase that. And we were actually seeing that. It was very gratifying. Scientists have a lot of great ideas. They seldom pan out. So I was really excited about it. And we wanted to run the experiment on another mutant mouse. And we were doing that when all of a sudden the data for our control animals completely changed.
So these are supposed to be the normal mice with almost no chromosomal abnormalities.
Right. And it was literally 1 week we ran the experiment. Controls had this low 1% to 2%. And the next week, it was 40%.
Wow. I mean, that's a dramatic, dramatic increase.
Yeah. Of course, the first thing we said is, oh, we must have a mutant here by mistake. But the level was actually even higher than we've been seeing in the mutants.
So how did you start to track down what was going on?
Well, you know, I started to think about an environmental effect, and I tried to chase everything I could chase, everything I could think of chasing. So we looked at, you know, where's the air coming into the mouse room? You know, there's construction going on here in the hospital. Is that impacting my animals? Is the food changed? Does somebody come in and spray for insects? And what insecticide are they using? So we chased a lot of things. And I have to tell you, I couldn't find anything. And I went off on vacation thinking, I'm never going to figure this out. But I just had the people in my lab running the experiment every week because we thought, okay, we know when it started. Maybe we'll see when it stops and we can figure it out that way. And when I came back, I noticed that the cages and water bottles that our animals were living in and drinking from were showing really funny signs of damage.
Well, and when you say cages, I mean, we're not talking about metal cages. We're actually talking about almost like a plastic aquarium box.
Right, exactly. Plastic cages, plastic water bottles. And I actually stopped the technician who ran that facility, and I said, you know, what's going on? It looks like our cages are melting or being damaged. And she said, I know, and I've checked everything out. And we both looked at each other and said, you know, maybe this is the source of our problems. Turned out those cages were polycarbonate plastic, which we all know is made of bisphenol A or BPA. And it was a sudden exposure to BPA that caused the change in our data.
How did it go from 1 week, this is not an issue, the plastic cages are fine, to the next week, the plastic cages are causing...
Ah, who's the villain here? It turned out we had a temporary worker come into the animal facility, and we had two bottles of detergent. This is the floor detergent. This is the cage washer detergent. He picked up the floor detergent, and he added that to the cage washer.
And presumably a harsher cleaner or...
You know, I wouldn't say harsh. The pH was different. So the manufacturer suggested that these cages be washed in a low pH detergent, and this was a high pH detergent. And so I don't think it's that it was any more harsh, but it turned out one wash with this detergent was sufficient to damage the plastic, and as soon as it was damaged, it started leaching BPA. The interesting thing is we couldn't see any physical signs of damage, so it affected my mice long before we could see any changes.
And that's really scary because you're talking about a very subtle difference, a change from acid to base. And it's not like any of the detergents that most of us use in our daily lives are labeled as
high
pH, low pH, or plastic safe or not plastic. You know, we don't have that kind of information on detergents.
No, we don't.
How easily did you accept that this is what was causing the abnormal eggs in your mice? I mean, did it just immediately, this has got to be the culprit, it's plastics, or did you feel kind of hesitant to jump to that conclusion?
Well, it made sense, but it took me into an area that I didn't know anything about. So, of course, the first thing I did was run across the street to a Department of Polymer Sciences and talk to somebody there. And he said, oh, of course, you know, this is BPA and there are some adverse effects. And I said, well, not anything like this effect. But I was faced with trying to understand whether it was really the BPA or whether it was something else and how my animals were getting exposed. Was it the water they were drinking or the cages that they were living in? And the cages were a high temperature polycarbonate, which means they were built to withstand autoclaving for sterilization. So I thought, well, you know, I don't know what this high temperature piece does. Maybe it's not BPA. Maybe it's whatever makes this polymer high temperature. So we had quite a lot of things to work out, but we had essentially no way of doing that because my entire facility had damaged cages and water bottles. All of my animals had been exposed. And the first thing we had to do was a cleanup effort to get us back to square one so that we could start running some experiments and testing these different variables.
And how did you do that? Did you replace them with new plastic cages or did you completely overhaul what your facility looks like?
We had all of the cages and water bottles replaced, and we actually brought in new animals because we didn't know whether these effects would last for generations or whether our animals would be, you know, safe to study. So it took us actually many, many, many months, and we probably lost a year of research time in the entire adventure, misadventure. But when we finally got everything back to normal and confirmed that our animals were behaving normally, we went on and actually started to run experiments, intentionally damaging cages and water bottles and finding that we could do that in one exposure to the detergent. And then putting animals into the cages, putting animals into normal cages with damaged water bottles and asking whether we could recapitulate the effect. And the answer was yes, with both.
And you can make it that dramatic, that jump from 1% to 2% to almost half of animals.
Right. It turned out that either the cage alone or the water bottle alone didn't give us quite as strong effect. And when we put them both together, we got back up to the level we'd initially seen.
And why do those exposures by damaging the cages as opposed to, say, feeding the mice a known quantity of the chemical that you think is responsible?
Right. That was the next step. Well, how much are they getting? You know, is this more than we would ever see in a lifetime, or is this actually really relevant to humans? And the only way I could think to look at that was to take the water from the damaged bottles and send it off and have it analyzed to see how much BPA it contained. And we did that, and once we had a number, we actually started to use this to dose our animals and to go on both sides of that high dose, low dose. I am not a toxicologist, not even really an accidental one. I'm a geneticist, so I think like a geneticist. And my response was, wow, okay, if I can see an effect at this dose, how low can I go and see an effect? And a toxicologist would have gone the other way. How high can we go and what happens when we go higher and higher?
So how low can you go?
You know, we could go pretty low, but, you know, for us initially, we wanted to just get this paper finished out there. And we've gone back to do some dose response studies and look at these things, as have some of our colleagues. Because, as you know, this whole field has kind of blown up in the last 15 years. There have been lots and lots of studies done and lots of questions asked about different doses and what's relevant to humans and how do we actually figure out how to best do these studies in rodent models.
I'm talking with Dr. Patricia Hunt. This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. More after a short break. This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. I'm talking today with Dr. Patricia Hunt. She's a Meyer Distinguished Professor at Washington State University. Her primary research interest has always been the genetics of how human beings produce normal, and in many cases, abnormal eggs. But in 1998, she got distracted by a mistake, and it has led to a whole new line of research on the impacts of plastics on human reproduction. Patricia Hunt, before the break, we were talking about the fact that just an accident, a mistake with what detergent was used on the cages in the water bottles that you keep your mice that you're studying in, led to this huge jump in the prevalence of abnormal eggs. And really led you into this whole area of research of plastics. And I have to say, when I first encountered that story, I thought, well, that's really interesting, because I remember a few years before that, there had been another similar story where another researcher, in this case studying breast cancer cells, couldn't figure out why some of her cancer cells were growing much more quickly than they should, and finally brought it back to the plastic Petri dishes. So how common is it for researchers now studying the health effects of plastics to have stumbled into this as a field of study simply because it was essentially unavoidable?
It is actually a common story for those of us who started into this field very early on. Of course, many scientists were lured in because they saw the results we were getting and said, we need to look at this in our system. But yeah, Anna's lab essentially was going through the same sort of event that my lab was going through. And there was a yeast lab well before either of us that was trying to grow yeast in plastic flasks, and they encountered the same sort of thing. They weren't getting the appropriate results due to this hormone-like chemical in the flasks.
Does the fact that you got into this research as a complete accident make your results perhaps that much more compelling?
Oh, I don't know about that. It certainly made them newsworthy in the beginning. But I think for my scientific peers, you know, we're scientists, we're skeptical. We don't believe anything till we see it in our own lab. So I had several colleagues who are in my field interested in eggs and the genetic quality of eggs. And the first thing they wanted to do is repeat these experiments themselves. And there were three papers published, all of which showed effects on eggs. But one of those was really interesting because it's a colleague of mine from Germany. And she said, you know, it's interesting. We don't see chromosome abnormalities. We think the egg actually dies before it completes the division. And we discussed it, and she published her paper. And that was immediately sort of used against us to say, look, nobody can repeat this Hunt study. When in fact, you know, it doesn't really matter to the parents whether that egg dies first or creates a chromosomally abnormal embryo that dies. It's a really serious problem. And we've now gone on to look at several different stages of developing an egg. And we find three different points where the egg is vulnerable to the effects of this chemical. And that's just the developing egg. You know, there's many other areas of our body that are controlled, driven by hormones. And so lots of my colleagues have stepped in to look at things like heart development, lung development, brain development, development of the reproductive tract.
And they see effects in all of those areas?
There are reports of effects in all of those areas. And in lung, you would not think, well, it's not really, you know, we don't think of that as a hormone-responsive tissue. And yet there's a very interesting effect on the developing lung.
So talk about that hormone component. I mean, the thinking is that the BPA, bisphenol A, that the plastic is made out of is essentially acting as a synthetic hormone.
Right. These are called endocrine disruptors because our hormone system is our endocrine system. And actually, BPA is one of many chemicals that has hormone-like properties, can interfere with the actions of our hormones or mimic our hormones. But it's kind of a really interesting one because although we think of it as a synthetic estrogen, it's actually so much more than that because it can behave like other hormones. It can interfere with thyroid hormone function by binding up the receptors for that hormone. So it's not just a synthetic estrogen.
So you've got this incredibly complex problem, and not all of the studies match up exactly in what they're finding. As a scientist, is that troubling to you, or is that simply what you would expect with such a complex problem.
It's fascinating. It's also frustrating. When we started into this area, we realized that we were seeing slight fluctuations in our data, and we began to suspect that it was diet. So there are naturally occurring estrogens called phytoestrogens in our diet, soy products, and other plant matters. And so one of the things we worried about is, wow, I wonder if changes in our diet from year to year are causing fluctuations. And in fact, we and others have run diet experiments, and we see that they can moderate these effects a little bit. So it's really interesting because we can't study any of these things in isolation. And it's even more interesting because we aren't simply exposed to BPA. We're exposed to BPA and a whole host of other chemicals. And trying to actually run experiments in the lab that actually mimic accurately human exposures and human life is virtually impossible.
Well, and when you get to the issue of different labs in different parts of the country, then running these experiments, I mean, if something as simple as what we're eating for lunch is affecting us from person to person, then, I mean, you've got to get to the level of, to truly reproduce an experiment, you'd have to be using the exact same cages, the exact same food. I mean, you can't even try to reproduce the air of one city in another city. How can you ever hope to get truly reproduced experiments when you have something so complicated and so sensitive?
It's exactly true. And one of the things we found is strain of mouse. The background, the genetic background, can play a huge role. And I think some of the problem in the field where things have been inconsistent, when you trace it back, you can easily see the effect of different genetic backgrounds on these experiments.
So do you feel at this point as if the scientific community has a compelling body of evidence that there are significant health impacts caused by BPA, by plastics, at least on the animals that are being studied in the laboratory?
I think the data from rodent studies are very compelling. There have also been some non-human primate studies, and one study in particular that was interesting. It's a very small group of non-human primates, rhesus monkeys, but six different tissues were evaluated from these fetuses that were exposed. And it was done by actually running the experiments and then phoning people like me and asking, do you want to study the ovary? Do you want to study the brain? And those animals were really interesting because all of them showed effects in every tissue that was examined. But not every monkey was affected to the same degree. So it's really like a human population where, you know, we can all be exposed or we can all be smokers and we don't all respond the same way.
You're listening to Living Lab. I'm talking today with Dr. Patricia Hunt about her research on the health impacts of exposure to plastics, particularly the chemical bisphenol A or BPA. Now, of course, studying this phenomenon in animals is interesting, but the end game is what is the impact on humans? How do we make that leap? Can we make that leap from a mouse or even a monkey to human beings?
You know, I would say we don't have a choice in that we can't study humans the same way. We have to rely on animal data. We always have for toxicology testing. So I think we have to use the data we acquire from animals to make inferences about humans. It's not always clear and straightforward, and certainly we're trying to do a lot of things looking at humans and trying to gauge what level of exposure we have. And a lot has changed in the last few years, so we're devising better and better methods of actually examining the levels. One of the things that happens to this chemical when it comes into your body is it's metabolized, and that inactivates it. And then you excrete it, and it's gone, right? Most of it, we hope.
And that sounds like good news.
That does sound like good news. But it turns out the way in which you take it into your body actually determines how rapidly your body's going to be able to metabolize it. So one of the things we've done with animal studies is we've made the assumption for many years that the major route of human exposure is through contaminated food and beverages. So we're looking at placing it into the gut and seeing what effect it has. It's actually metabolized really rapidly if you do that. But if you put it on the skin or you even put it in the mouth and don't just put it directly into the gut, but let it be absorbed a little bit in the mouth tissues, then it actually has a longer half-life, if you will, that active compound. And so that raises a lot of questions about, well, actually, how are we exposed? And is it valid to assume that it's really contaminated food and beverages?
And at this point, what we know is that we're getting it from a vast array of sources. It's not just coming from food. And some of the places that we get exposed to BPA are kind of surprising.
Yeah, kind of really surprising, because we all handle those pressure-printed receipts on a daily basis. And they're loaded with BPA. And
they're essentially coated with it. That's what makes the receipts shiny.
Yeah, there's a little matrix in the inside, and it contains BPA, and it comes off of these receipts and onto your hands. And the worst part is, even if you'd say, oh, no thanks, I don't need the receipt, you know, other people take those receipts and shove them in their wallet, which contaminates our money, which means BPA is in the money we handle on a daily basis.
I have to say, when I first heard that, I had been in the practice of, at the grocery store, handing my then 2-year-old the receipt as, here's something to do, play with the receipt while I finish packing up the groceries. And it really made me think twice about doing that.
I'm glad you stopped doing that.
You wear glasses, and I've heard you also mention the fact that, a lot of glasses are now made of polycarbonate plastic. And for those who would otherwise be wearing very thick glasses, that's a great thing. But then you also have this plastic really close to your face. Does that ever give you pause?
Well, you know, I mean, we can't just declare this evil incarnate. This polymer that creates this plastic has made our lives very, very nice in many respects. And eyeglasses is one of them. Those people who would have Coke bottles that were very heavy can now have light, nice-looking glasses. But what we need to understand is what the cost and what the benefit is. And, you know, I don't think it's leaching by the ton out of my eyeglasses. I'm more concerned about other routes of exposure. But the bottom line is this is a huge volume production chemical. So a lot is manufactured every year. And instead of decreasing in amount, it's increasing in amount.
Now, what do we know about how much of it is actually in our bodies, and how, I mean, you know, there seems like that there's huge potential between the plastic linings of cans. All of our food seems to be wrapped in plastic water bottles, plastic baby bottles, you know, the receipts, eyeglasses, all of these things that we're mentioning are potential ways for this chemical to get into our bodies. But what do we know about how much BPA is actually in people's bodies?
Well, currently there's a huge debate. Because, as I said, we're trying to find better ways to measure it. We're also trying to avoid contamination. So if I draw your blood to look at how much BPA is circulating in your blood, I have to make sure that that little plastic needle that I'm drawing and the tube it's going into are not contaminated with BPA. And then the machine we run for the analysis on, we have to test all the component pieces. And for years and years, we weren't doing all of those things. We were assuming we could look at blood, we could look at urine, we could accurately get levels of BPA in people's bodies. And we now know that it's much more complicated than that, and it's changed the way all of us do these analyses. But we've made a certain number of assumptions that are now being questioned. And as our techniques become better, it's not like we're seeing lower levels. It's like we're actually beginning to question whether or not we've been underestimating the levels. So I think right now these are interesting times because a lot's changing.
I mean, in 2004, the Centers for Disease Control said that we could find BPA in the blood or the urine of 93% of Americans. Is that still, 10 years later, an estimate that you would say is likely correct, or have all of the things that we've learned since then put that number into question?
I think that it's the number that most of us still quote, that it's over 90% of people examined. But I think if we collected blood and urine is kind of looking at what was in your body and what's been metabolized and excreted. If we looked at your blood and we looked at your urine, I'm pretty confident we'd be able to see it in pretty much everyone.
Do you ever feel like, with the complexity that is involved, with the potentially the pervasiveness of the thing you're trying to study, the chemical that you're trying to study, this BPA in plastic. And then in addition, the fact that it's very hard to actually study human beings directly. We can't experiment on human beings. That you're working with an unknowable, unanswerable question.
Well, you know, I think there's so many aspects of this that can be answered experimentally that it's not an unanswerable question. I think we always have the same problem when it comes to humans. We are the hardest beast to study, and we can do things like smoking. You know, we can study it for decades and decades and decades to try and demonstrate to ourselves that it causes lung cancer and emphysema and heart disease. We all accept that now, but it took many, many decades for that to become an acceptable notion. You know, my concern for all of these chemicals is there are an awful lot of them, and we're all being exposed on a daily basis. And the biggest risk is to the unborn child and the developing infant. And so I think we can't throw up our hands and say, oh, this is just unknowable. We have to keep using the best tools we can. And the challenge in this field is we need to invent better tools for testing chemicals. And this is driving that dialogue, and that's a very important dialogue.
You're listening to Living Lab. My guest today is Dr. Patricia Hunt. We're talking about her research on the health impacts of exposure to plastics and the chemical BPA. We'll talk more after a short break. Welcome back to Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. My guest today is Dr. Patricia Hunt of Washington State University. Her research on the impacts of plastic on developing eggs in rodents, but also then what that means for human populations, and really importantly, how scientists talk to the public about such important but such controversial issues. We have to go back, I think, to the second half of your accident story. There was the accident that happened in your lab that led you to the idea that the plastic cages and plastic water bottles were impacting egg development in the mice you were studying. Talk a little bit about your experience when you first started talking to the media about these findings.
Yeah, it was a baptism by fire. And most scientists, we hate to talk to you guys.
Oh, come on.
Because you always get the story wrong.
And, you know, it is a common accusation.
Well, and I've learned that you get the story wrong because we don't say it clearly. And I had to learn that, you know, in the course of interviews. And the interviews were terrifying to me initially. But with each interview, I learned a little bit more and a little bit more about how to present what I felt the general public needed to know. And for me, it was particularly interesting because at the end of almost every interview, you're asked, is there anything else we should have asked, or is there anything else you'd like to tell us? And at the time, I was really distressed because baby bottles and sippy cups were almost all made of polycarbonate plastic. And so I would always say something like, well, you know, what concerns me is that the most vulnerable segment of our population, our babies and our infants, have this stuff in their hands and in their mouths all the time.
Now, that could be a controversial thing for you to say, not only because of the potential health and economic ramifications, but you didn't have data directly addressing that issue. You hadn't looked at levels of BPA in the blood of babies who had been holding bottles or anything like that. What gave you the confidence to take that step and to even think about that and kind of think out loud in front of the public?
Honestly, as I said, we had this high temperature polycarbonate plastic in the lab. And I wanted to know, you know, what happened with just garden variety polycarbonate? And I couldn't actually find any. So I bought baby bottles. And we used the same detergent, and the baby bottles fell to bits. And I started talking to parents about this, and they said, oh, well, you know, you want these baby bottles to be really clean and really sterile, and so you put them in the dishwasher. And I thought, ooh, because dishwasher has high temperature, and that's an invitation for chemicals to leach out of plastic. And they said after a while they get a little hazy, and I went, oh, because we know at that point that polycarbonate is leaching quite a lot of BPA. And then after a while they get sticky. Oh my God, by then it's really leaching. And so I was really concerned about the fact that all the baby bottles on the market at that time, at least I think all of them, were polycarbonate plastic. So I kind of made this my personal mission, you know, is to express concern about this because I was really concerned. And, you know, just like that, new polymers came on the market. And at one point I got a call from a baby bottle manufacturer saying, what the heck is going on there? We're getting all these calls from concerned parents. And that was a wake-up call for me because I realized, you know, my science isn't going to change the world at all. But talking to people really is, because what consumers ask for, consumers get.
But your science could change the world, because without that science, where does the concern come from? And the concern isn't really valid, perhaps, if it doesn't have the science to back it up, or is it?
Oh, it's, you know, it's a nice thought, but the best science in the world, if it's not communicated effectively, isn't going to change anything. And, you know, as scientists, we learn to communicate with other scientists and we speak in our own little language. And trying to take yourself out of that world and place yourself into the world where you can speak to anybody about what you do is a real challenge for us.
And that's not something that most scientists are trained in, or particularly in the past have been trained in. Is that something that you feel needs to change?
You know, it's one of the things that I'm really hell-bent about now, because I'm trying to train my students and trying to impact other students, trying to teach them that, you know, effective communication is everything in our field. And even when we stand up and talk to other scientists, we frequently keep it within our own discipline and make other scientists just outside that discipline struggle to hear us. So one of the things that we do is try to teach our students to really, really make it accessible to a broad audience. And I tell them, you know, you have to assume infinite intelligence and infinite ignorance.
I think that gets to the core of what's called dumbing down science. That somehow, if you are making that assumption, that you are treating the other person as less, and that the full weight or complexity of the science can't possibly be portrayed that way. And so what you are conveying is an oversimplified, dumbed-down version of the science.
Yeah, and I've certainly had my students tell me that when I say, you've got to simplify this. Then they say, well, then they won't think I'm smart.
How do you get past that?
You know, I've really tried to simplify everything in my talk. So my slides are very simple. You know, my message is very simple. Because I always think about, what is the message that I want people to take home from my talk? And it's usually very, very simple. So I want to make sure that they get that. And it actually works. But training, you know, my students to do that, it takes a little while for them to become comfortable with that. And one of my students said to me, well, you know, I mean, that's okay for you. You're established in your field. But it's not okay for me. And I'm sensitive to that. But I think if they understand the power of clear communication, both in writing and in speech, they'll be unstoppable scientists. And that's what we really need to work on for the next generation.
As we have touched on multiple times, though, this is not a simple problem. Is something lost when you try to convey a simple message about the health impacts of plastics when they are so varied and influenced by so many different things?
You know, I think people can get that. You know, I think you can explain all of those things to them. And I think you can say, you know, this is one chemical of a host of chemicals that have these hormone-like properties that we need to be worried about. You know, this is complicated because in the lab, I can study mice and I can expose them to one chemical, but in your life, you're exposed to many. I can't mimic that well. I think people can understand that. And I think one of the things that's wrong with our current system is, you know, your average American does not have a very strong science background, and your average scientist thinks that they can't understand the subtle nuances of their work. But I really think that's underestimating the American population. I really think they can understand if we can learn to speak.
Do you ever worry, and I'm sure actually this accusation has probably been leveled, that you are fear-mongering beyond what we actually have the science to support?
I worry all the time. I worry about two things. I worry about maintaining my scientific integrity because I don't want to be perceived as an activist. I worry about talking to the general public and sending mothers who are already very nervous about how they should be raising their children and what their children are exposed to, and sending them home thinking, oh my God, it's hopeless. And when I talk to parent support groups, I frequently feel the need to apologize to them. I'm sorry, you know, I know it's not a happy message. And I've had them come up to me afterwards and say, don't apologize. We need to know this. And knowing helps me change my behaviors. And so that's what I really try to focus on, is what sort of practical messages can we provide that they can translate into their own world. And if they walk away from a talk just thinking, you know, I think I'm going to look at the ingredients in this before I start slathering it on my kid's skin, we've done a good service, I think.
In simply talking to a parent support group, though, and talking directly to the public, I think that's an activity that could in itself be perceived as activism. I mean, I guess there's a fine line, perhaps, between education and activism, but where does that line for you fall between what is acceptable and perhaps necessary, a responsibility of a scientist, and what goes too far and does perhaps damage your professional credibility?
You know, and I'm not sure I can answer that because it does feel like a tightrope sometimes. But I think that, you know, this class of chemicals, these hormone-like chemicals, are forcing us to rethink how we test chemicals. And basically, we're working off of legislation from 1976 when it comes to how we regulate, the demands for testing of these chemicals. And this class of chemicals means we need to rethink the rules. And it's clear that the traditional chemical testing paradigms, the tests we've used for decades, really don't work for these chemicals. And the change is coming. The change is slow. And it's not happening rapidly enough for people like me, because we're really concerned about the increasing number of chemicals that are entering our lives without really being adequately tested for safety. And if that makes me an activist, okay, that's one opinion. I think it makes me a concerned scientist who's armed with some data that's sobering.
As you say, there have been changes, and you can now go into any grocery store, drugstore, and find a whole array of BPA-free plastic products. And you're scrunching up your face here. Are they actually any better? Do we know if they're any better?
We don't know, for the most part. But you get what you ask for. And when concern about BPA surfaced and made its way into state legislators' offices, and people began to ask for bans of BPA, we got bans of BPA in sippy cups and baby bottles in many states. What we really didn't anticipate is, you know, that little BPA molecule could be tweaked. It has a little side chain that you can alter. Now, technically, it's not BPA. It's BPS or it's BPF, and it's a sister molecule. It's not BPA. You can label it BPA-free because it's not BPA. You, the consumer, will pay more of it for it. So it's kind of like we handed the perfect marketing tool to industry, and that BPA-free is actually no guarantee that you're getting a plastic that's free of this type of chemical. And I don't know how we address that, because currently you can't tell as a consumer what's in plastic when you buy it.
And I think that also gets at a fundamental part of how scientific information is incorporated into policy in this country. That in Europe, what's called the precautionary principle tends to be much more embraced. That if we don't know, let's not go there.
It's err on the side of caution, yeah.
And in the U.S., the attitude tends to be that if we don't know, then we don't have grounds to rule it out, to ban it.
Yeah, but don't make the mistake of thinking the European system is foolproof, because they're going through the same problems we are and currently critically reevaluating this entire question. What's frustrating is we should be doing the same thing, and there is legislation that's been stalled in Washington for a year trying to reform our Toxics Control Act. And, you know, we need to be moving on it, working on it. you know, there isn't a perfect system. But wouldn't it be nice if industry and science and legislators could all work together to devise something that is more workable, rather than thinking that, okay, now we've tested BPA and, okay, we pretty much generally agree that, that may have some problems. But now do we have to go and test each one of these new sister molecules that comes on the market? Wow. I could be busy for the rest of my career doing that, but I wouldn't be very productive.
And that could have major economic and social ramifications. I mean, that's an incredibly high bar, and as you say, an incredible amount of work to expect.
Right.
That could potentially hold back progress. But at the same time, there's how do you begin to weigh those two against each other and find an appropriate middle ground?
You know, we need a dialogue first, don't we? And sitting down at the table together has never been something that industry and academic scientists have achieved. And currently, the way we test chemicals for toxicity relies on tests that largely can only be conducted by industry because we don't have the funds to do those kinds of tests. So regulators, when they sit down at the table to weigh the evidence, they can understand these industry tests because they understand how they're done. And then they get this study from this woman who looks at eggs and sees effects on eggs, and they don't know what to do with that because they don't know what it means. They don't know how to interpret the data. So we're asking regulators to do something that they're not prepared to do, which is to weigh scientific findings from academicians that are not normally part of the dialogue and try to come up with a way of understanding that science and determining how much weight they should give it. And that's not fair. They can't do that.
We've talked about the complexity of the problem, the difficulties of actually doing the science the right way, and then the difficulty of extrapolating from animals to human beings, and then the difficulty of communicating that to the public, to regulators, and the incredible tangle of all of the information and competing concerns that have to go into creating legislation or regulation for these things. How do you keep from being overwhelmed or discouraged by that huge array of complexity and uncertainty?
I think for me, you know, the scientific questions are always uppermost in my mind. So there's always that next question. And in this field particularly, every study we've done has opened three new doors to studies we have to do. So it's expanded so rapidly that we can't keep pace. And that keeps most of my attention focused. It's not my job to fight the regulatory battles. And one of the things I think we have to remind ourselves to do is to look back rather than simply always looking forward. Because when I look back to when we stumbled into this area, BPA was not a household word, and now it is. And so consumers are getting savvier and, you know, they're learning. Scientists are learning. And I guess I have to convince myself that we are moving forward. But I think much like climate change, it's frustrating to a lot of people because it's not moving as fast as you think it needs to move, given the magnitude of the problem.
Patricia Hunt, thank you so much.
Thank you, Heather. It's been fun.